This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in a bit, a law and politics expert here in Wisconsin explains this week's indictment of former President Donald Trump for his efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Now, police pursuits are becoming more common in Milwaukee. The city's police department engaged in more than 1,000 chases last year, an average of nearly 3 a day. And Jonah Chester reports that as chases have increased, so have injuries to innocent third parties.
On August 1st, 2019, 19-year-old Laquan McCoy was driving through an intersection on Milwaukee's north side. Another driver in a stolen SUV blew through a flashing red light going about 70 miles per hour and into the driver's side of McCoy's car. The impact sent McCoy's Jeep into a tree on one side of the road and a parked car on the other, killing him. Antoinette Broomfield is McCoy's mother.
My husband ended up passing away from stress, from a heart attack, from just constantly being in pain and worrying about it. My other children, my daughter, she's not the same. She's different. My son, he's not the same. Everybody is grieving.
Aaron Fitzgerald was driving that stolen SUV and fleeing police. He got a 10-year prison sentence and 8 years of extended supervision for McCoy's death. But Broomfield's quest for accountability didn't end with his imprisonment. She's suing the city of Milwaukee and the four officers who pursued Fitzgerald. Sitting with her attorney, she says those officers could have called off the chase earlier, avoiding the tragedy.
Oh, some days I just don't even want to get out the bed. Some days it's just bad. Some days I just wake up and I just wish it all was a dream. I know everybody make a mistake, but why could I even just get an apology that it happened to my child?
Broomfield's lawsuit comes as police chases in Milwaukee are becoming more common. Annual pursuit rates in the early 2010s generally hovered around 50 chases a year. In both 2021 and 2022, officers pursued more than 1,000 suspects. Pursuit reform advocates attribute that surge to the department's current chase policy. It allows officers to pursue for more offenses like reckless driving. In the early 2010s, the department had a stricter policy. Officers could usually only chase those suspected of a felony. Craig Sarnow is an inspector with the Milwaukee Police Department. He says policy changes through the 2010s allowed officers to address drug dealing, reckless driving, carjacking, and other crimes.
We used to have individuals that would try to bait Milwaukee police officers into getting into pursuits, knowing full well that we couldn't because our policy was so restrictive.
But advocates say a looser chase policy also puts more innocent people, like Laquan McCoy, at risk. From 2007 to 2022, uninvolved bystanders were injured in more than 3 times as many police chases as officers were. And that data may not provide the full picture. Jonathan Ferris is the chief advocate for the Wisconsin-based Pursuit for Change. He says police chase data is often inaccurate.
Most of us who have been following this for a fair number of years have seen more than enough examples of pursuits that were not logged as pursuits.
And police departments do have other options. Things like high-tech trackers, tire deflation tools, and even a grappling device that allows an officer to entangle a fleeing vehicle and slow it down. But MPD Chief of Staff Nicholas Desiato told the city's Fire and Police Commission last summer that many of those alternatives are, quote, practically impractical.
They can be effective when appropriate, but it also requires incredible coordination and sometimes just dumb luck. In terms of for the hot pursuit to effectively combat reckless driving, it's just a necessary tool.
Sarnow says the department is open to reviewing the current chase policy, but he doesn't expect it to change anytime soon. Jonah Chester, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. Now, the pandemic changed how and where many of us decided to live, and cities of all sizes have adapted to their changing demographics and economies. With remote workers having more freedom to choose their location, the cities themselves have been competing to attract a class of younger professionals who often tend to be higher-paid white-collar workers. Many cities have invested in urban renewal and new development to provide the amenities these workers are seeking, and some are turning to social media influencers to market their downtowns. Our next guest says these campaigns often leave a lot of people out and lead to lots of different communities trying to market themselves in unique, all in roughly the same way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen your city, big or small, grow and redevelop in recent years? What do you think the identity of your local community is? Have you been part of an effort to rebrand, do placemaking in your community? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David A. Banks is a lecturer in the Geography and Planning Department at the University at Albany, SUNY. He's the author of the new book, The City Authentic, How the Attention Economy Builds Urban America. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into some of the details, I want to throw one more concept onto the table here. This one goes back before COVID, and this went to a lot of cities, the idea that, hey, to rebuild, especially maybe in a post-industrial rust belt type of city, we need to attract the creative class. We need to make an attractive community for these young professionals to come into. Can you talk a little bit about that notion? Because I think it's a key to your argument in the book here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's really kind of the beginning of the story, right? Is that after deindustrialization in the United States, and this also happens in Europe, is that cities don't know where to turn for investment dollars and for, in terms of like tax revenue or, you know, employment opportunities for its citizens. And so there's really just a policy vacuum there. And then in the 90s, that vacuum is filled by several attempts, but what really sticks, you know, they're all kind of similar, but what really sticks is Richard Florida's 2002 mega hit, The Rise of the Creative Class. And what the argument basically says is, yeah, what you just described, that people, especially high income earning creative professionals, are highly mobile. And for that reason, you know, the way to capture the value that they create is to make them happy and to find, you know, fun things for them to do and just generally make them comfortable. And so a lot of cities did that and saw some success. But what happened in a lot of cases was that you kind of got like a tail that wags the dog sort of situation where you make this downtown, or you put a lot of investment dollars in a fun downtown, but the creatives never come. And then you also then have a bunch of small business owners that probably go out of business because the clientele is just not there.
You focus in your work on small to mid-sized cities in upstate New York. I think there are probably comparable stories to be told in similar sized cities here in Wisconsin. In effect, there's this weird paradox where all these communities, you know, they're competing with big cities for people, and they're saying we're going to make our own unique identity, but they're all doing it in many cases, it seems like you're saying, in very similar ways to each other. How has that played out?
Yeah, I actually, one of the longest examples that I have in the book that is not in upstate New York is Milwaukee. Because maybe people listening from Milwaukee might remember this. Probably a little less than 10 years ago, there was a design podcast called 99% Invisible that did a show about city flags, you know, like the flag that a city has. And Milwaukee's was rated one of the ugliest because it has, it actually has like
a
flag.
It has everything on it.
Yeah, yeah. It's a whole kitchen sink full of stuff, including another flag, like on the flag. Mm-hmm. Incredible stuff. And so the end of the episode basically like calls for people to like redesign their city flags as a sort of civic boosterism. And in Milwaukee, a young graphic designer makes a flag and presents it. I think they calls it like the people's flag. And it gains some traction, but it also gets understandably, there's a pushback because, it's the creative professional that showed up that likes Milwaukee, but maybe is not from there. I don't recall if he was born there or not. But quickly the flag conversation gets turned into a conversation about who belongs and who gets to say they are part of Milwaukee. And it's a conversation of class and race in that. And it never really came to a full conclusion as far as I understand. But, you know, that is a little anecdote for the way that cities are rebranding all across the country and in other places around the world, where they recognize that the city has to in some ways act like a brand, in that they have to cultivate a personality or a reputation of some kind that exists beyond their borders and that is both welcoming but also unique, right? And sometimes uniqueness can be off-putting or just intimidating. And so the thing that cities try to strike in their brand management is what I call predictably unique, where you just give a little riff on what is widely kind of understood is just kind of like small town, small city pride.
Social media is a newer part of this story since the original creative class book came out. And you see in your book and your research, some communities, community leaders and others trying to become influencers, in effect, and going with a sort of online influencer playbook. What kind of things do you see?
Yeah, social media intersects in a lot of interesting ways. And if we just want to keep it to influencers, there's a few different kinds, right? The one is like your homegrown influencer, someone that becomes popular on their own through whatever mechanism is at their disposal to become popular on whatever social media site they've chosen. And sometimes that can kind of bring everyone with them and raise the profile of the city, right? So one example from around me is, you know, there's a small group of people that do a kind of like video short kind of series that's on several different platforms, and they've started merging into traditional media, the newspapers and local television. And in that way, you know, like they're not only like getting the capital region out there, they're getting the they're telling people within the capital region about new things that are happening. Now, another example would be, you know, something like Baltimore, or Washington, D.C., both of those cities are right next to each other, but both of them independently had ideas of like, well, we will go to a talent agency and hire influencers that already have an audience with the kind of demographic that we want to attract, and we will basically pay them to have a weekend trip in our city, and that will heighten the profile of our city in these core demographics that we've identified that we want to attract. And then the third one is something that I called like place-based memes or memes of place. And this is where people make usually jokes, a lot of the times they're self-deprecating, about what it's like to live in a place. And in those cases, you know, it'll be like, you know, a common one is like the starter pack, where you say, you know, name of city, starter pack. And then it's just a collection of items, mostly mass market consumer goods, that are supposed to reflect the kind of people that live in a place.
We're talking to geography and planning lecturer David Banks about his new book. It's called The City Authentic: How the Attention Economy Builds Urban America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where you live, what kind of growth, what kind of changes have you seen in your area? Do you see this kind of outreach to bring in younger professionals? Do you think it's a good idea? Do you think it's changing your community in ways you're not always on board with? What does it mean to live in the place you live in? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with David Banks. His new book is called The City Authentic: How the Attention Economy Builds Urban America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you see your local community, or the state of Wisconsin for that matter, marketed? How should communities reach out to draw in people? Are you bugged by the way you've seen these things happen, maybe where you live or used to live? What lured you if you came from out of state to your community in Wisconsin. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, I don't want to miss this point of your book. You see a lot of downsides to the stuff, the kinds of outreach we're talking about. One of them is, and other people have brought this up over the years, is, okay, if this outreach to young professionals is successful, it brings people in. One concern is that so they have more money, they drive up the costs of rent and goods and services, and the people who already live there get squeezed out. How big a part of the problem is that?
Yeah, it's big. It's really big, right? So, and I don't want to make it seem like there is an obvious, easy answer out there that people just choose not to pick up, because that's not the case. It's very difficult, especially when pretty much all of our land is out in a marketplace, right? To keep prices affordable while also making a more desirable product, right? Because like everything else, as you make things nicer and better, they're going to have more value, and that value is going to be reflected in the cost of rent or the, you know, median house price, right? And so a lot of the times you become a victim of your own success if you do make your town or your neighborhood or your city, you know, that much better. You're going to have a hard time retaining the people that still live there and let them benefit from that rising tide. Now, one thing that you see that's even more pernicious than that is that oftentimes the increase in land values also undermines the very thing that might make the place desirable in the first place. Is it right? So I think a lot of people, especially if they've lived in a very large city, have experienced this, where a neighborhood that used to be very funky and had like lots of artists and lots of interesting things happening gets noticed. And then the experimental kind of places become coffee shops, and then the coffee shops become art studios or art galleries, and then stuff starts turning into like the Bank of America, and then there's a lot more chain stores, and eventually the thing that was the spark that was there is now gone, and what's replaced it are like chain stores and you know, like expensive lofts. Right. And that's that happens all over the place. And it's a very robust phenomenon. And so that tells us that, you know, that's going to happen absent direct intervention. And there's some tools on the table, but nothing that's used widespread that works 100% of the time.
Another concern, a little more subtle, I think, in your book, David, is who is at the table? Who's deciding what the identity of a community is? Who is doing the outreach? And you suggest, I think, that a lot of people are left out, as you mentioned with the Milwaukee flag debate. What did you see as you looked at those communities in New York?
Yeah. So now I'm gonna be kind of New York specific here, with the one caveat that a lot of states in the United States have something similar to this, right? The jurisdictions will be different. How you get on the various committees will be different, and a bunch of other things. But I'm not fluent in you know, Wisconsin.
Sure.
Government, but here's what happens in New York, is that there are 10 regional economic development councils that compete with each other sometimes, but mostly carry on competitions parallel to each other within their respective areas, right? And this is good for a place like New York State, where you have obviously New York City, which is much different, much denser, much richer than a Schenectady, a Rochester, or like the Southern tier. And so by setting up these parallel competitions, you do get a little bit more democracy in this, or more places get a shot at the big prize, which is lots of state money, either in the form of direct grants or low to no interest loans, is usually the structure of the assistance. And and those grants and loans are spread across lots of different programs that have lots of different goals, everything from, you know, bolstering the state's agriculture to celebrating the history of the Erie Canal, right, and everything in between. And what happens is usually a city, a nonprofit, or a for-profit business will apply for anywhere from 5 to 7 figures of aid in order to do a certain kind of economic development project. And then the council in each region gets to rate their applications. And who sits on the council are appointed by the governor, and they are almost always the high-level executive or owner or president of a bank, a hospital, or a university are a lot of the big ones. And then there are also, like, you know, large manufacturers if they're in the area, or some sort of large employer, and a couple of successful entrepreneurs, right? But these are appointed by the governor, and they make their decisions, and they make their decisions out in the open. But you could also criticize this as just sort of like taking those smoky backroom backslapping deals and just, like, you know, taking meeting minutes, but you haven't changed anything important. You've just kind of, like, made it a little bit more transparent. But the end result is that, you know, these appointees are picking winners and losers. But in the process, they are trying to say that everyone that they did pick meets some sort of broader goal or vision that the council has articulated. And in that way, we take what we call a market economy and we plan it, right? We by region, based on what some of the more powerful actors in that regional economy think the rest of the region should act like or behave like.
And David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's David Banks. His new book is called The City Authentic: How the Attention Economy Builds Urban America. Coming up, former President Donald Trump was indicted yesterday on 4 felony charges for his role in attempting to overturn the outcome of the 2020 election. We'll dig into the charges and what's at stake. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the current uptick in COVID cases and what a large analysis of long COVID patients teaches us about the ongoing neurological disease. Now, former President Donald Trump was indicted yesterday on 4 felony charges for his alleged role in attempting to overturn the outcome of the 2020 election. Here's Special Counsel Jack Smith.
Today, an indictment was unsealed, charging Donald J. Trump with conspiring to defraud the United States, conspiring to disenfranchise voters, and conspiring and attempting to obstruct an official proceeding. The indictment was issued by a grand jury of citizens here in the District of Columbia, and it sets forth the crimes charged in detail. I encourage everyone to read it in full.
We're taking a close look at the indictments, what's coming next in the case, and what consequences a conviction might have for the former president and current leading candidate for the Republican presidential nomination. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the most recent Trump indictment? Do you think the charges against him are justified? Does this indictment change or confirm your opinion of the former president? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Howard Schwaber is a professor of political science emeritus and affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Howard, I want to listen to more of Jack Smith's statement yesterday outlining the gravity of these charges.
The attack on our nation's capital on January 6th, 2021, was an unprecedented assault on the seat of American democracy. As described in the indictment, it was fueled by lies. Lies by the defendant targeted at obstructing a bedrock function of the U.S. government, the nation's process of collecting, counting, and certifying the results
of the presidential election.
Howard, as compared to the other felony charges, the federal classified documents charges, the New York State charges over alleged misuse of campaign funds for hush money, how serious is this new set of indictments?
It's extremely serious in at least two distinct ways. First of all, the crimes charged are major crimes. These are major felonies, and a conviction would be a very big deal. I mean, let me put my cards on the table. I simply cannot visualize an ex-president being led away in handcuffs to prison. But if anybody other than an ex-president were convicted of these crimes, that's certainly where they would end up. If they were convicted, I said, that's an assumption, obviously. The other reason, though, they're very serious is that Jack Smith has tailored these very carefully. He did not, for example, include a count about inciting the attacks of January 6th as part of his prosecution. He stepped to a series of charges. There are four of them in total, all based on the same set of facts. So he really only has to tell one story, so to speak. And all of them are based on facts. It's fairly easy to demonstrate. I mean, there'll be counter evidence, there'll be denials, but the fact-finding process doesn't need to become intensely long and complicated. Of all of the prosecutions, this may be the one, just by the way it's designed, that is most likely to proceed to trial and outcome before the 24 election.
Reading through the indictment, something that struck me up front is, first of all, Jack Smith says the president had the right to make, the former president had the right to make legal challenges in courts to the election outcome. He had the right to make false statements publicly about the election outcome. But he said he knowingly made those false statements in efforts to persuade members of state legislatures, the former Vice President Pence and others to change the outcome. How important is it that, as Jack Smith says, the president was aware that the statements he was making were false, that he was aware that these were election lies he was promoting?
That actually turns out to be an extraordinarily difficult question to answer with precision. Certainly, the mere fact that he said something false is not, in and of itself, that's protected by the First Amendment. If it's just a statement that isn't part of a course of conduct. And when you hear some commentators saying, oh, this is all about protecting Donald Trump's First Amendment rights, they're trying to claim that this is a prosecution just for making false statements. That's not how this thing is written, though. Smith was very, very careful to write a complaint that, an indictment that focuses on conduct and specifically criminal conspiracies. So now the question becomes, if Donald Trump, for example, as is charged, said false things to people in Wisconsin to get them to fraudulently act as electors in order to obstruct the operation of the U.S. government, right? That's one of the charges. How important is it that Trump knew that what he was saying was false? And the answer is almost certainly it will have to be shown that he was at least reckless. For a criminal conviction based on defrauding the United States, as opposed to the conspiracy to interfere with the operations of official functions, there it might be necessary to show that he actually knew the things he was saying were false. Along with the First Amendment defense that's been floated in the media, another one that's been floated has been what might be called the delusory defense, that Trump honestly believed he'd won the election, that all of these things that he was saying were true. Smith includes references to statements that Trump made indicating that's not the case, that he actually knew that he had lost the election, that what he was saying was not true. It's certainly very easy to show that people told Trump that what he was saying was not true, but there's a hazy area there in the middle. What happens if he says, I didn't believe anything I was told, I didn't think anything I was saying was false, I acted on the advice of some of my lawyers, even if other lawyers disagreed? Now, at a certain point, from Smith's perspective, the danger here is that Trump will be able to lay all the blame on his advisors and his lawyers, these six unnamed co-conspirators, and escape liability for himself by essentially saying, well, I just believed everything that one or another of these people told me, and the most you can convict me of is choosing to believe the thing that was most favorable to me, which, of course, in and of itself is not a crime. The response will be that, of course, he went further. He organized, and it's interesting that the indictment focuses so heavily on the fake electors. Mm-hmm. That really is the core of the case, I think, that by himself and in conjunction with others, Trump went about arranging for fake electors to present themselves as real electors in a number of states, including Wisconsin. That conspiracy, everything that was involved in making that happen, that's really at the heart of these four charges. And that's where the question of what was Trump's state of mind is going to become so important.
Talking to Howard Schwaber, affiliate faculty at the Law School of UW-Madison, longtime professor of political science, looking at these new felony indictments, federal indictments against former President Trump over his actions after the 2020 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. If you've read through the indictments, what stood out to you? What is your reaction to these charges? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Howard, yes, definitely the false elector scheme really stood out as a through line here for this. The idea that the president's legal advisors were organizing this effort to have Republicans in states, including Wisconsin, sign papers saying, yeah, we're the electors, deceiving them, according to the indictment, in some cases saying, oh, no, this is only a contingency in case the courts flip this. But with a plan, the indictment states all along to present those to Vice President Pence and others to say, look, the election outcome from Wisconsin is in question. Look, there's two different sets of electors here. We got to do something about this. Can you talk through what you saw in that part of the indictment?
And actually, that part of the indictment is very, very interesting to me. So Smith identifies in quotes from three memos at three different times having to do with this scheme, internal memos by Trump advisors. And the first one, the earliest one, said, let's set this up just in case. And that's what some of the fake electors were told they were doing. That's the misleading part you just mentioned. They were told, don't worry, we're not going to pretend you're the real electors. You know, we're only going to have this slate prepared in case there comes to be a need to have a new slate of electors because the outcome is overturned. But then there were a second and a third memorandum. And by the time you get to the third memo, the plot is quite specifically to have Pence, who's assumed to be in on the deal, in his role as vice president, get on the floor of Congress and declare that the fake electors are actually the real ones and accept them, and on that basis award the election to Trump. Now, that goes way beyond the original version or the version of the first memo and the version that was told to some of the fake electors, and again, a version that I've heard bruited about in the media that said, no, this was only a contingency plan to have electors prepared in case the electoral outcome in these states, like including Wisconsin, should be overturned. But the internal memos show that by the time the date of January 6th got closer, the team had pivoted and were planning to actually present these fake electors as real. And that's the dishonesty, fraud, and deceit part. And I think it would be very hard for Trump to pretend he didn't know that that was fake. Even if you accept his word for it that he believed the election was stolen, he believed there was massive fraud, right down the line. He certainly was aware, having read these memos, that these were not the official lawful electors and that he was involved in a plan to have Mike Pence, on his behalf, pretend that they were, and thus, well, in popular parlance, we would say steal the election, but in the legal terminology here, interfere with a lawful federal government function. By which the results of elections are collected and counted. I think that's a very difficult count for Trump to get out of. It's not just about false statements. It's about an extended effort involving a lot of people over an extended period of time to organize all these fake electors and to have people reach out to them and to talk to state officials and to have people on his team talk to each other. This fits the classic description of a large-scale conspiracy in a complex criminal scheme. And there's no question that the scheme was unlawful. And what these memos show is that there was an unlawful intent. There was an intent to use this scheme to achieve unlawful ends. That comes pretty close to making this case. And that's one of the reasons I say I think this case is interesting and potentially dangerous for Trump, because the narrative is pretty clear and the facts are very well established. So the only real question for a jury will be, how do you interpret these facts?
I want to bring in a caller on, I think, on the fake elector issue. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. Frankly, I believe that Josh Call, our attorney general, has been markedly deficient with respect to prosecuting to the fullest extent of Wisconsin law the false electors. And that in addition, One of them was given some kind of free pass to continue participation in the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Don't you believe that the case against Trump, as outlined in this indictment, would be much stronger if we already had convictions on the books?
Tom, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Howard, Attorney General Call's colleague in Michigan has charged the counterparts in that state. I imagine if I were one of the people who'd signed the electorate, I'd point in the indictment and say, no, look there. It says they deceived us into thinking we were doing a contingent declaration here, not as part of the scheme. What do you think of what Tom had to say, Howard?
Yeah, I understand Tom's position. I don't actually think that Wisconsin's prosecutions against fake electors strengthens the case against Trump, and partly for the reason that you just said. As Smith acknowledges in the indictment, in at least some cases, and I want to emphasize some cases, he believes it to, his office believes it to be the case that these fake electors were deceived. In some cases, they were not. So each one of those electors' trials will involve a separate finding of fact of whether they knew what they were doing was illegal and so on. The fact that is relevant for the prosecution of Trump is that he attempted to organize and successfully organize this effort to have them sign off on these documents. Whether or not they were committing crimes or knew they were committing crimes doesn't alter the fact that he was involved in a conspiracy to use them to violate federal law. And that's why these are really separate legal proceedings. I do think it was shocking that one of those electors was allowed to continue to participate on the Election Commission. I suspect some prosecutions at least are coming against fake electors in Wisconsin, but they are, while there's the story, their story is the heart of the prosecution, but their conduct is not. It's the conduct of the president himself that's at issue.
Thanks for that call, Tom. We're talking to law and politics expert Howard Schraber from UW-Madison, looking at yesterday's indictments released of former President Donald Trump for his alleged attempts to overturn the results of the 2020 election. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the legal side of these charges? Do you have thoughts on the political side? Do you think Donald Trump should end his campaign for president if convicted? Does this indictment impact how you would cast your vote if he stays in the race, either in the primary or a general election? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Howard Schwaber, professor of political science emeritus and affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison, looking at the most recent indictment of former President Donald Trump for federal felony charges related to his attempt to overturn the 2020 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about these indictments, your reaction after hearing about them, or maybe reading them yourself. What do you want to see happen next? Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jerry is with us in Viola. Jerry, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I just want to make sure I understood you correctly. If I find a lawyer that says what I'm doing is legal, then regardless of what I'm doing, I'm off the hook. Did I understand that correctly? And then my second question would be, so if I had enough money, I could just pay a lawyer to say what I was doing was legal, meaning that if you're rich, you can do whatever you want.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Howard, former President Trump has made an argument along those lines, like, hey, I was getting great advice from fantastic legal minds saying that what I was doing is legal. I don't think that's a get-out-of-jail-free card in any case. How limited or successful could that argument be?
Yeah, there's no really good answer. So it's called an advice of counsel defense. If I was told by a lawyer that what I'm doing is perfectly legal, am I not permitted to just rely on that legal advice? And the answer is sometimes, but not always. So we mentioned there are six unnamed co-conspirators. From the description of the indictment, it's quite clear who at least five of them are. And they're mostly his lawyers, Rudy Giuliani, John Eastman, Sidney Powell, and Jeffrey Clark. And a guy named Ken Cheeseborough. Sorry, I left him out. You know, all of them were lawyers. All of them were exchanging legal advice. It is true that Trump was being told things by, for example, Sidney Powell that his other lawyers were telling him were nuts. And he will argue that he chose to simply believe Powell. There's a couple of limits to the get out of jail free card, though. One, the person involved Trump has to not know that what he's being told is absurd, is nonsense. And here, you know, as I say, there are references to conversations and statements he's made that indicate that he knew he had lost the election and he knew this was false. Two, the advice of counsel defense only works for legal advice, right? So if someone says to the president, it is entirely within your powers under the Constitution to tell Mike Pence, you know, not to accept the ballots or something, the electors, that might be protected legal advice. But it does not extend to things like, for example, assertions of fact. If one of the lawyers said, you know, there is absolute proof of massive fraud, that's not legal advice. That's not any more special coming from a lawyer than it would be from coming from someone else. And this gets back to our question of what state of mind has to be shown. Does it have to be proved that Trump knew he was lying or only that he was reckless in making false statements? And that may be different for different counts. The third thing about the defense of counsel thing, and Jerry asked if I have enough money, can I just pay a lawyer to say whatever I want him to? Possibly, but that lawyer may end up going to prison. And you know what's interesting about these unnamed co-conspirators, at least five of whom are lawyers, is that there is a suspicion that Trump will try to say this was all the lawyer's fault and try to dump everything on them. Each one of them is facing possible prosecution, and we have to assume that Smith's office is trying to put pressure on each one of them to turn and provide evidence against Trump in order to try and get themselves out of trouble. And they're not named now, but they can always be named later. This gets to yet another complication of the whole deal, which is, would Trump take the stand at trial? Almost certainly he would not want to, because on cross-examination, he can be confronted by all the various statements that he's made, indicating that he knew he had lost the election, or indicating, you know, that he was saying false things or engaged in illegal conduct and so on. On the other hand, if he doesn't, any of these co-conspirator lawyers who turns on him can get up and testify that, yes, he knew perfectly well what he was doing was illegal. So it's a very risky situation. What is usually a shield, the attorney-client privilege, becomes a source of vulnerability if you're engaged in a criminal conspiracy with your lawyers, because privilege does not cover criminal acts, and that is entirely what's being alleged here.
Thanks a lot.
That was a long answer. I hope it makes sense.
No, an interesting answer too. Thanks, and a great question. Thanks for that call. I want to give a listen to a central figure here, former Vice President Mike Pence, now a competitor in the presidential race with former President Trump. Here he is responding to the charges earlier today.
Sadly, the president was surrounded by a group of crackpot lawyers that kept telling him what his itching ears wanted to hear. And while I made my case to him of what I understood my oath to the Constitution to require, the president ultimately, continued to demand that I choose him over the Constitution.
In our last few moments, Howard, and we could end up with the former vice president being asked to testify in this case. A lot of the indictment draws from his notes taken at the time. He is a central figure in the story told by the indictment. Can you talk about what might happen at a trial?
He will certainly be called to testify. As you mentioned, you know, there's too much in this indictment to get through quickly. The New York Times has a very nice version of the text, and I encourage listeners to look it up. It has a nice commentary in the margins explaining what's going on in different places. Pence took contemporaneous notes about conversations that he was part of with Trump and the other advisors. It's not clear to me reading the indictment whether he was actually taking notes in the room or jotted them down immediately afterwards. But the word contemporaneous is used, indicating it was effectively at the same time. And that's important because that goes to the reliability and accuracy of the record. Those notes are at the core of several of the allegations, including references in Pence's notes to Trump saying things that indicated he knew what he was saying was false, or indicated that he knew what he was doing was illegal. So I think there's no question Pence would be called as a witness. There would probably be an attempt to have those notes introduced. It might not work if Pence is available, but he could then be called as a witness and asked about his statements. And Pence's public statement that you just played for us suggests to me, at least, that he is quite willing to stand up and say that ex-President Trump was involved in a criminal conspiracy. You really, I think, have to go back to either Iran-Contra or before that Watergate to see a moment where you have a president involved in such a group of people making a criminal enterprise. This is an extraordinary charge. Of all the charges against Trump, this one obviously is the most important. This one has to do with the attempt to steal the election and corrupt the democratic process. And it's and the indictment lays out a very powerful and very damning case that says that Trump was at the head of nothing less than a criminal conspiracy. And I think it will be difficult for him to defend himself against these charges.
Thanks to our guest, Howard Traber from UW-Madison, looking at these new indictments against former President Donald Trump. Yesterday on the show, I talked to a psychologist about jerks at the workplace and how to figure out if we, in fact, are the problem coworker. She had some great advice on figuring that out and on building better relationships with our coworkers. We heard a couple of questions and stories from you along the way. We also got this email yesterday with the subject line, "Who, me?" Emmanuel in Strawberry Point, Iowa writes, "I work at home, alone. And yes, I am the jerk in the office." Smiley face emoji. "I have questions," but that was the whole email. I guess, Emmanuel, recognizing the problem is the first step, and I hope you can have some productive conversations with yourself and work through this. Check out the whole conversation about jerks at work at wpr.org/centraltime. I guess, even if you work alone. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.